You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 453 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carzino.
And we're coming to you in different locations. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the four-time WNBA champion, Storm.
Seattle, Washington.
You know, sometimes when you...
You don't say that word very often. I haven't said it that many times. And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. We are back! It has been too long, but we are back in your feeds.
Without a dope pod to step
to. Mafe edition. Is there anybody else that I'm forgetting?
53. Probably. Do you want me to open the file?
I always want you to open the file.
It's like the equivalent
of... There's never a time where I'm like, keep the file closed today.
Do I need to... Should I say the thing? And you're like, yes. Say
if
the
you
thing.
Have a file, open the file.
I have Keith Butler listed for the Seahawks. I'm just going to go ahead and write in Boye Mafe.
You might want to update the file.
Well, if they're current, we're more likely to remember them. And Husky legend James Clifford.
Wow.
So there you go. It is the Boye Mafe edition.
I was, this is totally unrelated, but that's how this podcast goes because we are back, baby. are back. I was watching a YouTube video of every 50-point dunk in slam dunk contest history.
How many are there? There's probably, okay, well, let me do the how many piano tuners are there in the city logic. There's probably, I would say, an average of about...
I don't have this memorized. I can't... Oh, okay. It was just a video. I can try to figure it out and then Google it later, but it's not like... I was just watching a video of the dunks. I wasn't like, that's 1, 2, 3, 4, or whatever.
So anyway. There's been about 40 dunk contests, and I would say there is an average of about 3. So I'm going to say 120.
I think you are too high on that. That is my
maybe I'm thinking too recently, and the 50s were harder to get back in the day.
Yes, there's grade fixing or whatever they call it. Grade inflation.
Oh, there was a grade inflation discussion in the Discord.
Was there really?
There was.
On the dunk contest?
No.
Oh, yeah. Literally about, of course, the Discord. They weren't talking about sports. They were talking about college grade inflation.
Their dumb brother and college professor Noah Cohen was talking about grade inflation.
How dare I imagine that people were talking about sports in there?
The Pelton cast regrets the air.
We're all just waiting around for baseball season. That's what I feel. Every conversation that happens, every time anybody gets upset, it's like I could just distill it down to be like if a child's freaking out and they're like, what are they freaking out about? I'm like, don't listen to what they're saying. They're hungry. And with the Discord, what they're saying is whatever they're upset about, anything at all, we're all ready for baseball season. But the thing that I noticed was there is a Sonics player who had, or can you name every Sonics player when they were on the Sonics, not somebody who played for them after or whatever, who has a 50-point dunk?
There's a Sonics player who had a 50-point dunk. Well, they played for the Sonics.
There are more than one.
Okay. Desmond Mason.
Yes.
Did Sean Kemp have a 50?
There's only one other, as far as I know, for the video. I'm pretty sure there's only one other.
I want to say that Terrence Stansbury dunked for the Sonics in the dunk contest.
Multiple 50-point dunks. And I will say, you look back, this is what my point was first off, I saw this first dunk by Terrence Stansbury, and I was like, I wasn't familiar with your game. And then in the next dunk that they showed that he got a 50 on, he was on the Sonics. And I was like, wow, that's even more surprising that I wasn't familiar with your game. Terrence Stansbury is kind of the lost great dunker from that era. Because some of the other 50s are like
because people want you to think that the only people who won the dunk contest back then were Dominique Wilkins and Michael Jordan. But it turns out random guys just won the dunk contest back then too.
The Dr. J dunks are not good by modern standards. The Jordan dunks aren't very good by modern standards. The one who actually holds up, and Spud Webb is just like, he's short and he dunked it. You know, like that's the whole experience. I remember even in the 90s, we knew that was suspect. Like it didn't take us 2 decades to figure it out. It took like 6 years to figure out that the 80s dunks were pretty suspect. But Terrence Stansbury, who at no point in the 90s watching the dunk contest and caring, never was it like, you know, who is actually a pretty good dunker was Terrence Stansbury. Name didn't come up, has not come up, not until I watched this video. And I was like, Terrence Stansbury, really pretty excellent dunker for, I think he was the best of the dunkers for the time period because he was doing it with no fame.
Okay, there's 86 as of 2019.
There you go.
And Mac McClung has at least 8 since then. So we're in triple digits. I'm very confident. So I was over by a little bit, but not by that much. Okay.
It's basically like eras of players. It was just kind of funny because it's like, okay, this player dominated this year. And there's some people who you just like Andre Iguodala having a 50-point dunk. I would have never imagined that.
Did Andre Iguodala have a 50-point dunk the year that Chris Anderson took like 20 attempts?
Maybe. I don't know. They didn't also show in the video who else attempted things.
All right, that's just what I have it connected with it. And then people like are like, oh, the dunk contest is so terrible now. It's like, you guys didn't sit through Birdman spending like an hour. Oh, I think the dunk contest,
after seeing all these dunks, I mean, again, it's the same thing. Like, you tweeted about it. Did that tweet get traction? By the way, I mean Blue Sky. You skeeted about it. Did that skeet get traction? Because I thought you
definitely are not using that term on this podcast.
You were dead on about, that's what you're competing against. Fuck these other four people or other three people. It's like Max McClung is competing against every dunk that has ever happened in dunk contest history.
Which Mac McClung actually does pretty good against every dunk.
Mac,
dunk contest.
You called him Max earlier. You're the fucking NBA writer. So I was like, you called him Max. I'm going to go with it too.
Wait, did I?
Yeah.
I knew I did it that time. I because I felt that I did it wrong.
I was like, I must be wrong. His name must be Max.
I also typoed his name earlier on Blue Sky. No, I wouldn't say I got a lot of traction. I mean, he got 91 likes.
Wow.
But not as much as we should go pull a Costanza and leave on a high note after his reverse dunk over the car. Again, Mac McClung.
He had good dunks, though.
The other dunks were very worthy.
The other ones were pretty good. But
it is still kind of wild he'd use that as his first dunk of the night.
The car, there was like a lot of pomp and circumstance of the car pulling out, and I just kept imagining being the guy who is driving the car.
The guy, it took a long time to park the car.
He's like, back it up more. Mac's like, come on, a little bit further. A little bit further back, and you're just like, I know that if that was ever to happen to me, I don't imagine myself as Mac McClung. I always imagine myself as the guy driving the car, because as an artist manager, you're never the person on stage. You're the person who's like, we need somebody to drive the car, and it's like, I guess it's me. I guess I'm going to be the one doing it. So I'm like, I know exactly what that guy was feeling after my first ever time driving in New York City was in straight up downtown Manhattan traffic in a van that I'd never driven in before. And I was like, they're like, can you just drive this around for a second? We have to go do the stereo cum session. And I'm like, all right, well, I'm happy it's not a stick. I watched the session from my phone, having driven around New York, because that's
Sarah,
the job I have.
Can Sarah from Bodies dunk over a car?
Absolutely.
That'd be a good video.
I didn't say what size the hoop was. Or the car.
The car is the real question. Speaking of imagining yourself in various roles in the dunk contest, shouts to friend of the pod, Matt Hewer, who I think at least the second consecutive year served as a stand-in in the dunk contest.
A tall
practice.
Guy. Yeah. See, he knows his job. They're looking around and they're like, we gotta find a tall guy. And he's like, I'm here.
He filled the Evan Mobley role for, I don't know, was that Mac McClung's final dunk, I think. So Matt's 6'8", a little bit shorter than Evan Mobley, who is 6'11", but Mac McClung still managed to clear him with ease. So there you go. The dunk contest, the most important thing that's happened over the last 2 weeks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Should we get to this week's toast?
Absolutely, we should.
Well, we start at NBA All-Star Weekend, which is where the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame announces their finalists for the upcoming Hall of Fame class, which includes several people with local ties this year, most notably Sue Bird. This snuck up on me because they changed the rules. It used to be you had to be retired for, I don't know, 3-4 years, and then they moved it down to 3, I guess, because Sue retired after the 2022 season, is now eligible to go into the Hall of Fame in 2025. Obviously, she's going to make it. There was some discussion on Blue Sky. There's no voting totals. None of that or anything is public. So we won't know if somebody decides not to vote for Sue Bird. We won't know if she's unanimous, a la Ichiro, but there is no question. It's Sue and Ichiro. It's
not
gotta be
a la Ichiro.
Well, the question, a la Ichiro. Sue and Ichiro going into the Hall of Fame the same year. Is this the greatest Seattle Sports Hall of Fame year of all time?
No.
Okay. Which one is it then?
Probably when Ken Griffey Jr. went in, or Randy Johnson, or Gary Payton.
Definitely not Randy Johnson, who did he even go in, win it as a Diamondback.
I'm this is nothing against Sue.
Okay.
My feelings have been registered on the
your feelings have been dismissed. Also, longtime Sonics color analyst Marcus Johnson for his playing career. Back when I thought the rules were what I thought they were, I thought that this was going to be the year for Marcus Johnson. Now, Amare Stoudemire and Carmelo, or Amare, I guess, was already eligible, but Carmelo Anthony is now eligible as a first-timer. So a little bit more competition. We'll see if Marcus, who's been a finalist before, gets in. I've written that basically everyone who has become a finalist has eventually gotten into the Hall of Fame, except Marcus Johnson and then Kevin Johnson, who subsequently had some personal issues that I think affected his candidacy. Nothing like that in Marcus Johnson's case, so it's just a matter of when, not if, for him. And then the last Hall of Fame finalist with local ties, Gonzaga coach Mark Few. Also one of your favorites.
I was going to say, we are not toasting to all of these people.
If Mark Few and Ichiro hung out.
Oh, that's not even close. I don't dislike Ichiro. I just don't like Ichiro as much as everybody else. Mark Few is on the list.
All right, congrats to the UW Men's Distance Medley Relay team, which today won the record in the 4,000 meters with a time of 9 minutes, 14.1 seconds, beating the record by, it was not the school down south. It was a club team from the state of Oregon. So bringing that record back to the fastest state in the union.
There we go. Took it away from that slow state down south. Back to its rightful home in Seattle, Washington. You love to see it. Fastest state and school in all of history, not just currently, of all time. Fastest school ever, excluding nobody. Thank you.
So we knew that UW was a track school, but I guess I didn't realize it snuck up on me. That UW is also
sneaking up on you right now.
Apparently so.
You better watch your back.
maybe that says more about me than it says about them. But we're also a field school.
There we go.
Because congrats to UW pole vaulter Amanda Mole, who set the NCAA record in women's pole vault and became just the fourth American woman ever to clear 16 feet at any point during their career. She's a sophomore. This is quite remarkable stuff.
We do it all up here. And I think there's also another special toast in order to you for getting married this past week.
The way you highlighted it sounded like to you, the listener, but you weren't awarding Pelton Guest Sports Figure of the Year. So the reason that there was no podcast last week, immediately after the trade deadline, my now wife and I flew to...
That's so crazy. It must be crazy to say, because it's crazy to hear.
It is very crazy to say, for sure.
When you change titles of somebody... It actually, wife still sounds kind of crazy. Like when I say it, it's just a weird word to use.
It just makes me think of my wife. To the Big Island of Hawaii, and got married there during the Super Bowl at sunset, which... shouts to the Eagles for making sure the game was over by halftime by the time we left and did not really miss anything at all. But well, it was
how
awesome.
Was the ceremony? Anything else? Was it a good sunset?
It was a great sunset. It worked out well because it wasn't like super hot, because I was wearing a sport coat on the beach and a shirt and tie. So, you know, it could have been sweaty if it was like full sun bearing down on you. But then the sunset came out and there were some awesome pictures on the black lava rocks there on the beach. So it was very cool. Went to a nice dinner afterwards. The other fancy dinner we had at Canoe House, I think, was our best meal on the trip. But it was a great time. And it's Japanese menu with obviously local ingredients, local Hawaiian ingredients. So yeah, that was an outstanding meal.
My favorite. Are you eating on the beach there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Having those meals. When I was, this was a couple of times ago being in Hawaii. But I got really, really sunburned. And canoe storage site were Duke, Kaha, Namoku, and Babe Ruth sought respite in the idyllic beaches. Is that the Babe Ruth?
I don't know. I didn't see anything about this. Hold on here.
But I remember going to like a dinner outside, like Feet in the Sand, and having teriyaki in Hawaii, actually, at one of those places. It is a very nice place to be. How hot was it, by the way?
It was like, I mean, it kind of depends where on the island you are, but it was like high 70s. It wasn't super hot.
Oh, yeah. That sounds
amazing.
Was
perfect. Yeah.
Did you burn? Because I remember going to LA.
No, because I spent very little time in the sun.
Oh, okay.
Like, Saturday, we had to prepare for the wedding. Sunday, we had to prepare for the wedding. Like, Saturday, we were like doing things to get ready. Sunday was preparing. And then Tuesday, we spent a bunch of time driving to go see Kilauea was erupting for almost precisely 24 hours. So we happened to time it perfectly. They said that it'd been erupting about once a week for a couple of days at this point. So that was like an awesome experience to see.
That's pretty cool.
And then Wednesday we drove even longer because we're going to the south end of the island.
In Hawaii just end up driving so much. It's like, well, what they don't tell you about Hawaii, you're just constantly driving.
It turns out the Big Island, it's bigger than the other islands. You'd never believe it. So yeah, there's more driving. But so I went to the southernmost point in the 50 states and saw a green sand beach, which is one of four in the world, and had quite an experience getting there. So
how does a beach become green sand? I took a lot of rocks classes in college, as I called them. How does a beach
rocks
become
for jocks
green sand?
So because of the fact that it's like ash from the volcano rather than the lava flows that make up most of the area, there's this green crystal called olivine that gets trapped in there. So
I like that this toast turned into a geology explanation.
Yeah, you know, like the Pelton cast contains multitudes. This is like the Discord in audio form. And as I understand it, then when the olivine ash, it erodes away and the ash kind of is washed out and doesn't remain sand, it gets washed out to sea, and only the olivine crystals get ground down into sand. So it was really an incredible experience, which multiple members of the Discord had also done. So that was exciting.
Awesome. Well, my favorite thing about the wedding was the Discord discovering that you would become married. I think Jimmer follows you on Instagram.
Yes, Jimmer was the first to post about it.
And then everybody being like, congrats. And then the amount of texts that I got from people separately being like, holy shit, did Al actually get married?
You got texts about it? That's very funny.
From people who wouldn't text you, like friends of mine, but who are just like, what the fuck? Al got married? And I was like, yeah, it's a thing. I'm like, it actually happened. Yes.
It's also a thing that they call me Al.
Yes. Well, congrats.
Thanks so much. Well, on a sadder note, we are saying farewell this week to Heaven Sent. Azel Stevens is closing the last outpost of his chain, which competed with his namesake, Azel's, in Lake City at the end of the month. Obviously, we pitted Azel's and Heaven Sent head-to-head in our search for Seattle's best fried chicken. I vividly recall stopping on my way back from Everett in Lake City to pick up the Heaven Sent before we met up to eat the two of these.
We were at Fremont Brewing Company, right? Yeah, we sat outside at Fremont. Wow.
We did, yes.
It was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. I was coming back from a storm game in Everett. That's how long ago it was. So we chose Heaven Sent. We considered it the better of the two. But
they were
sadly,
both pretty good at the time because we got good as hells. And the thing is, I mean, this is sad to see because this is really good chicken. Honestly, from Azel's, from Heaven Sent, the only issue that they had is, you know, sometimes the name just matters more. And the branding that Azel's had
in the history,
it was just, they were too far ahead. The quality of the chicken didn't make a difference. Azel's was too far ahead. They still are. I mean, I don't know if Azel's is doing amazing as a business overall, because I do think they expanded probably too quickly. And like the location near me in Fairwood closed a couple of years ago, but.
Well, the location near me in West Seattle is doing strong.
Is it?
As far as I can tell, yeah.
But Heaven Sent, apples to apples across the board, was better fried chicken than Azel's. So if only he'd been able to keep the original location. Obviously, you know, complications happen with things like that, but it was phenomenal while it lasted.
And it's always well-deservedly retiring when this closes at the end of the month. Certainly a legend in the Seattle food scene. So where did, yeah, Heaven Sent reach the semifinals of the competition? All right. We also this week, returning to happier news, are congratulating Marshawn Lynch, who is joining the cast of Euphoria for season 3, one step closer to winning the Academy Award.
To winning an Academy Award. I mean, I don't know if this is going to get him that much closer to winning an Academy Award, but...
I just think it's the next, you know, phase in his evolution as an actor. Although, I got to say, Mom went to go see the movie that that Marshawn is in and was disappointed in it.
But she didn't... It wasn't him specifically. Jan didn't even know he was in it. She didn't even see him.
Unaware.
I haven't seen this movie, so I don't know how suspect that is, that Jan was unaware, but...
I know how suspect it was.
Just because it's Jan, or have you seen the movie?
Because I've seen Marshawn Lynch before.
Okay.
He's a recognizable guy.
I'm kind of fascinated by it. When she said she couldn't tell who it was, I was just like, how many people who look like Marshawn Lynch were in this movie?
It was the guy who looks like he could be an NFL running back at once. That's the Love Hurts that Marshawn is in.
I actually found it. So the day after the Super Bowl, you didn't watch. I'll tell you about the Super Bowl later. Eagles won. But
did see half?
This whole halftime show, a bunch of America didn't like it. But anyway, the rest of America did like it, so that was good. But Marshawn Lynch was advertising. Starbucks had like a free cup of coffee the next day, and Marshawn Lynch was advertising it. He is so good at advertising things. It is incredible. And you're like,
you know where he cut his teeth? Beacon Plumbing.
Yeah, no, it's kind of wild that Beacon Plumbing got Marshawn that early on, because he is like national level figure. And it's so funny that Marshawn Lynch, of all people, ended up being probably the best and most marketable, possibly even athlete, like corporate sponsor that we have at the moment. And that's, again, excluding nobody right now. Marshawn Lynch might be it. It's so funny that like Tom Brady is out there just like fumbling his way through Super Bowls, and Marshawn Lynch won the Super Bowl somehow. It was an incredible moment. I was thinking about that the next day, that how far he's actually come overall just from having a great personality. And look, you could be anti-capitalist, and I am, but I also am like, Marshawn, come on. I'm down for it. Go get paid, Marshawn.
Hit the game, not the player. Yeah. Did you know that Marshawn is in an upcoming heist movie with Eddie Murphy, Pete Davidson, Kiki Palmer, and Eva Longoria?
I didn't know that, but I'm not surprised by that information.
You didn't know that, but you did know that.
Yes. The thing is, I think Marshawn Lynch could be in serious film also. I do think Marshawn Lynch can win an Academy Award. Did somebody boldly predict this?
You boldly predicted it.
I boldly predicted it. Okay.
Yeah,
wasn't it like it was a supplemental bold prediction, right?
Well, yeah, because it was a bold prediction for the future.
Long bold prediction. I'm just telling you, you better watch out on that one, because when it happens, oh yeah, I'm going to be gloating.
I mean, it's not like anyone was like, it's not like it was an Ichiro-style debate where someone was like, oh no, no, sir.
I do think Marshawn Lynch can win an Academy Award. Also,
Marshawn Lynch is a poor actor.
It'd be a pretty easy argument to make.
I mean, yes. But none of us will make it.
A24 people. That was...
you know, Marshawn Lynch was in an A24 movie.
I'm very, very aware. Very aware.
Looking up here.
Was it actually A24?
I'm pretty confident it was A24.
Bottoms.
Maybe it wasn't.
Yeah, I don't think it was. Distributed by MGM. Sorry.
Wow. Tough beat for me. It felt like an A24 movie.
No, the reason it didn't feel like an A24 movie is because it was entertaining to watch.
God.
This is my other hill to die on, where it's like a slight feeling about a couple of movies, and now it's just like boiled down to this is it. I am anti.
Okay. Well,
don't even make good horror movies.
That's a no such thing.
Good horror movies? Are you?
I'm sure there can be well-made horror movies, but there are no good horror movies.
I went to Mopop yesterday. Did I tell you that? I told you that.
Yes, you did. Your 10 to 15 children also told me about it.
It was the first time I'd been there in so long since I almost worked there. And they have the Lombardi Trophy. So now in the last year, I've seen the Husky National Championship Trophy, the crystal that's at Heck Ed, as I will always be calling it. At Mohai, the Sonics Championship Trophy, and the Lombardi Trophy at Mopop. So I don't think I've ever seen it before that I can recall.
I have a photo with the Lombardi Trophy, Sonics Championship, and both the first two Storm Championships.
Where are the Storm ones at? Are they at the facility?
Yeah, I think they're just in
there. Get those into a museum. Come on. All these other ones are in museums.
I suppose so. I think the Sonics Championship Trophy wasn't at Mohai before the team moved. It was just in our offices back then.
It wasn't as much history and industry as it is now.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a little bit.
All right. Is the news bad?
It's not good. Should we talk about what you did after you went to Mopop yesterday?
Absolutely, we should.
Because you went to Cardoon as part of our search for Seattle's best cookie, not abandoned. The number one sign in the search is not abandoned is when the two have to specify that it has not been abandoned.
Not made from dead people's hair.
First opened in fall 2022 in the cafe space at the Nordic Museum, Cardoon moved to a standalone location just down the block last March, where they are serving house-made Chinese and German-influenced bites, great espresso, and specialty drinks.
Yeah, the flavors are kind of all over the place. When you say that, the flavor profiles are not any specific, I would say,
miso streusel. It was quite good.
Oh, see, yeah, they didn't have any streusel when I was there.
They didn't have any cookies when I was there, which is why I had the streusel. I mean, I probably would have gotten both, but that's, I tried to go there on Sunday. You made it there.
Did go
Monday.
There. Well,
yes,
try
right,
to.
Tried. I succeeded. They didn't succeed in giving me a cookie.
They failed. They're the ones who are wrong.
Cardoon was number one in the Infatuations rankings of Seattle's chocolate chip cookies with their lava chocolate chip, which features salty licorice caramel and spices. They say is an homage to Ballard's Scandinavian roots. I'm unclear which of the spices or the caramel is, or the licorice is Scandinavian exactly. The Scandinavian listener can let us know on that one. But it's interesting because I feel like
the salty licorice caramel. I'm trying to. The spices,
you didn't get those notes?
Well, I didn't know. I'm saying I don't think the spices are particularly Scandinavian.
Right. Which part of it is Scandinavian? Yes. So I feel like there's broad crossover here. With the Ben's Bread has a caramel chocolate chip cookie. And then even it's been a while now, admittedly, since I had it, but the gochujang, gochujoodle, or maybe it's the chocolate chip that they have at St. Bread. They're all kind of on the same corner. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, no, I'd say that's a pretty safe assessment. They're all close-ish to the same region as well. So you could kind of view that as this type of cookie region in Seattle. Which
it's
is true.
The caramel chocolate chip region. We have the fresh hop region of Washington and then the caramel chocolate chip region of North Seattle.
Yeah. Salted caramel chocolate chip region of Seattle. It's true. I mean, it's a specific type of thing. It's just like, you know what you're going to get when you're going to a specific type of area, and those types of the people who are living in that area want a specific type of cookie. I feel like it's not that complicated. Like,
I mean,
it makes
I don't
sense to me. That
I don't live there, and I want that type of cookie too, to be clear.
I am good with that type of cookie. Oh, I don't.
This is a take.
No, and I love St. Bread. The Cardoon cookie to me. So we got the lava chocolate chip and also the rose cookie,
which is kind of like a biscuit cookie. It was very different.
So this is described as melt in your mouth, which is yes, roasted chickpea and cardamom rose cookie inspired by I'm gonna mangle this Iranian Nokodochi. Nakhochi. I don't know. I'm not gonna pronounce that correctly. But I think the rose cookie was the one that stood out to me a little bit more.
Interesting.
They both, the spices, I mean, literally, yeah, the rose cookie, Kayleen spit it out and wiped her tongue. So, and said it tasted like eating a Costco chicken. But I thought it was kind of incredible.
Like eating a rotisserie chicken?
Yes. Huh. So, but the flavor, okay. I like that the... Number one, you know, like strange flavors is always what I'm going to go towards. And so the spices in both of these, you could really, really tell on the spices. It wasn't a hint. It was there and it was present for both the cookies.
I
would say that would be the difference between Cardoon and the Saint Bread, Ben's Bread types of cookies, right? Is the spices were way, they stood out way more at Cardoon than they did in either of those more traditional bakery cookies.
I would agree with
that. I'm not sure if that's necessarily a good thing, though. And in this cookie, I think it's basically like, yes, it was a great cookie, the lava chocolate chip cookie. If I had to view it apples to apples with Saint Bread, with Ben's Bread, which company, which one? We did the Ben's Bread and the...
Ben's
the
Bread was competing against Seawolf.
Against Seawolf. I think we ended up choosing Seawolf. We preferred Seawolf. We preferred
Ben's Bread.
Okay, because I love Seawolf. But again, all three of those... I think if you gave me the option right now and you were like, which would you rather have, the lava chocolate chip cookie or the Saint Bread chocolate chip cookie? This is a memory of it because it's been a while. The search is not abandoned, but I want to do the bracket before the bracket. But if my preference is for one of those other cookies, it's difficult for the lava chocolate chip cookie to be in the bracket because they are kind of similar in some ways. And I think that was the thing that stood out to me the most. Wow, you look like you're really about to make a point.
Now we've set the bar way too high. So my thought was, I think there was a more complex depth of flavor to the lava chocolate chip cookie than some of these others. And I think that's what the infatuation was responding to. That's not the number one thing I'm going for in a cookie. I think texture is the single most important thing as a cookie. And I got to tell you, eating it straight, I found it to be very dry.
Really?
I heated it up in the microwave and got those chocolate chunks melted a little bit. And then I think it was on the same level. But I didn't feel the need to do that with Ben's Bread or Saint Bread. And that, to me, is a distinguishing thing that pushes them over the top.
It's a classic list thing, though. Right? You want to give the answer that makes you appear. Sorry to shit on lists in general. Since search is God. But
we're definitely not going to have any rankings that depended to the end of this podcast.
The thing that people do when they're doing things like that is they try to pick out the most complex thing because it says about you as a human being that you're the most complex human being. And I think they kind of classically overthought it. But that is not to say that this isn't a good cookie. If I'm at Cardoon, I'm getting it 100% of the time.
Agreed.
It's just there was a little bit too much going on for it to be Seattle's best cookie. And that's the standards that we're judging it by. Again, to me, the rose cookie was a radically different taste than anything else that we've had and a radically different texture than anything else that we have. To me, I would put the rose cookie. If I were to be picking a cookie to put up for Seattle's best cookie, if I was Cardoon and they were submitting for this, I'd pick the rose cookie.
I mean, the other thing here, we got to be somewhat realistic. Went to Cardoon at like 2 on a Sunday and they were all out of cookies. Like, it's hard for you to be Seattle's best cookie if you only offer 2 cookies and you're out of them with several hours left to be open in the day. It's not like donuts where it's a breakfast thing. Like, cookies are needing to last throughout the day.
That's not what Cardoon is. Cardoon doesn't need to be Seattle's best cookie.
Absolutely like, not.
This is not, I think the whole, like I would have loved to have been able to have eaten all of the other bits, you know, an egg and cheese sandwich. I wanted all the things. I like the experience overall. As a coffee shop, 100%. I think it is phenomenal. So it was basically just like judging it from the standards of Seattle's best cookie is a difficult, you know, perspective to be judging almost anything by. Then the perspective of I was at IKEA and I got a cookie and I was like, pretty good, you know? kind of like, if I were judging it just
better
from,
than the Costco cookie.
I actually think the Costco cookie is better.
You had a very negative take on the Costco cookie.
They're both pretty, but that's when judging it from the perspective of, is this Seattle's best cookie?
Fair.
Not, do I like eating this cookie? Because if it's, do I like eating this cookie? The answer is almost always yes.
Cookies are good.
And I do think if we were just ranking, this might be high enough. The Cardoon Lava Chocolate Chip Cookie might be high enough ranking-wise to be in the bracket. But if I instantly know that my preference is for the St. Bread cookie, it doesn't really make sense for it to be in there. That's
right,
not
whereas some of the other ones that are in the bracket are a little different. More contrasting.
Yes. And I don't know. Again, it's a harder question if you were like, you could have a Hello Robin cookie versus the St. Bread cookie. I don't know the answer to that question instantly.
Exactly.
Right? So if I know the answer to that question right now, that's what makes it difficult. But I think quality-wise, I mean, I would highly recommend all of these places, you know?
Of course. It's definitely two Pelton Cast P.
I would highly recommend Cardoon. I would highly recommend Seawolf. I would highly recommend Ben's Bread. And I would highly recommend St. Bread. But I do know that St. Bread, to me, for all four of those locations, is number one. So, as of right now. So, I had a great time. I had a great time going. I loved eating it. And we're judging it from a very extreme perspective. However, better food court between Costco and IKEA is an interesting conversation. that'll be a search for later.
That's a question for another day, I must say. Because we've got so much more to get to, starting with week 3 of Lil Woody's Seattle Burger Month, which features the Lago Burger from Lauren Thompson of Cafe Lago, with oven-roasted tomato, pomodoro con alio, and balsamic salsa, goat cheese, arugula, shaved red cabbage, pickled red onions, and parsley on a traditional Lil Woody's patty. I wanted to find a way to capture the flavors and uniqueness that are only found in the Cafe Lago kitchen, Thompson said, and expressed that in a burger. For example, when I walk into Lago, I am always greeted with the aromas of tomatoes roasting in the wood oven, and I love the combination of balsamic and garlic in one of our marinades. I incorporated both of those classic Lago flavors into the burger that I believe represents this restaurant. Now, sadly, because I was gone and we did not have a podcast last week, did not get to talk about last week's burger, which was not really a burger, first off, if we're being honest, because it was a fried pork chop sandwich, which is not a thing I had ever considered eating before.
Oh, my God. Were
you aware of this?
I didn't know it was a fried pork chop sandwich.
From Jose Garzon of Bad Chantla, this was the Don Bronco, named after a mentor to him. And it was a fried pork chop bone in, with a bit of bone in there.
Bone in on a sandwich?
Yeah.
It is bold.
Bold. And then a fried egg on the top. And I'm trying to see now that it's passed, I don't see the description of everything that was on there. Or no, I guess it's just missing for the Don Bronco for some reason. But the aioli or the sauce that was on there was just outstanding.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, I had this on Saturday night after All-Star Saturday night, and it was quite phenomenal. So, 2 more weeks left in Seattle Burger Month. Well, I alluded to this earlier, but an update on expansion, and it's not great. There was no update in Adam Silver's press conference during All-Star availability, as he was not asked about expansion with some other pressing ownership matters, including the Minnesota Timberwolves' recent arbitration hearing that ruled that 25% Pelton Cast Sports Figure of the Year Alex Rodriguez and Mark Laurie are allowed to go forward with their purchase of the team from
there.
Glenn Taylor. Pending,
we may need a team to move.
Pending our arbitration of that hearing. So the Ringer is having expansion week this week. And friend of the pod, Howard Beck, had a piece today that had a bit of an update and said kind of similar things to what we've heard more recently from my colleague Brian Windhorst and others. but a couple, it's like some more specific quotes. Here's the relevant section. Now that the Celtics looks like it's taking a lot longer and it's going to come in at a lower price, everything has gotten pushed back, said a source who frequently speaks with team owners. Another plugged-in source added, this is slowing down. It's not happening anytime soon. I don't think they have the votes for it. The source said owners and league officials are now, quote, thinking much more long-term about all the implications, both financially and competitively.
We are dying, literally. We are getting older. I'm almost 40 years old now. You can't wait that long. I don't have that much life left anymore. Do you see how many cookies I ate this weekend?
I ate a lot of cookies too. I mean, actually mostly the cookie cake.
You also just ate a fried pork bone in sandwich too.
Yeah.
We cannot wait that much longer for expansion. This was supposed to be it. I'm sure I hope David Stern is very happy with the decisions that have been made across the league, because I do feel like the perspective is the NBA isn't the league at this moment. If we're being serious with ourselves, they don't have the steam overall as a league. There's all this conversation about, is the NBA dying or whatever, blah, 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 blah. The NBA is still going to be very successful, but the team values overall, there are other sports that team values are not slowing down. The Celtics decision isn't slowing down. And a lot of those leagues are leagues that don't have teams in Oklahoma City. If you're going out of your way, or I mean, honestly, the NFL is probably the highest value and they do have teams in smaller markets, but they did just move a team, two teams to Los Angeles, in fact. There is a reality of a sport like this that you need local fandoms to be extraordinarily large. You also need, on a national level, larger markets to have teams. They just fucked it up. They fucked up what they did. David Stern sold out in the short term. He wanted to hold cities hostage, and we're still being punished for it. The holding cities hostage, it was a short-term perspective about it just to get arenas. Arenas ain't that expensive anymore when we're talking about the kind of money that these owners have. People are able to pay for the fucking arenas, but the teams is what's expensive. And having a team in a place like Oklahoma City, honestly, like Sacramento, right? In places like that means that you just have less people who are interested in the league overall. So of course this is happening. The league is not in a healthy place because they cared so much about the holding taxpayers hostage and didn't think about what it means to have a healthy league long-term. It's not just about that.
Yeah, I think almost none of that made any sense.
you don't agree with that?
The leagues whose franchise values are escalating, including obviously the WNBA.
It's football. It is football.
Sure. Basketball is not football. Basketball is not going to be football just because you have a team in Seattle instead of Oklahoma City. And
they can withstand having a team in Jacksonville, but there are not that many major cities that they don't have teams in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any market as big as Seattle that doesn't have...
But they also, they don't need it as much. They don't need it. It is a national sport. And the NBA, in a lot of ways, is still a local sport, right?
No, quite the opposite. The NBA is by far the least, is a way less local sport than any but football.
I don't necessarily agree with that. You need the local
fandoms.
Football
is a national sport because of gambling and fantasy football. Basketball is a national sport because of stars. Baseball and hockey are the local sports.
I think basketball is more of a local sport than you're realizing right now. And I think that's what we're learning.
The problems that they have are much more at the local TV level than the national TV level.
The problems that they're having are at the local TV level because they don't have teams in the right cities. Because these small teams can't go get the kind of local deals that you could in a bigger city. A TV deal is worth more in Seattle, Washington than it is in Oklahoma City. Is it not?
I mean, it is, but the cities where the Diamond Sports Network collapses affecting the NBA are similar sized cities to Seattle. So again, I don't think this argument holds much water. Seattle isn't Chicago. Chicago is one of those places, by the way. Their local sports deal collapsed. So,
but there's still a rabid Bulls fandom. There is going to be a Bulls fandom that is extraordinarily large for a long period of time, even if the team is bad.
Yes, I agree with that. But again, Seattle is not Chicago. Seattle is like Phoenix and Dallas, where they're moving
the
team.
Problem. Shut up. If this isn't that's the most annoying thing.
I agree. It's a very annoying team. That's why I said it sarcastically.
If this isn't the problem, what is the problem? Why is an expansion happening? But this is capitalism. Or no, are they afraid that there aren't the billions of dollars to come in, or they're so scared of splitting up the TV money?
I mean, the reason you're concerned about, well, yeah, I mean, when you, anytime you expand, you're diluting your share of the TV money. That's, you're taking money up front.
But it means that they're concerned for a long-term about the TV cost. Money. They're scared about the TV money. There's
no
fear.
Because the more TV money there is, the more money you're giving up. So it's actually the opposite.
No,
again,
that's not
everything
exactly
you say
true,
is
though.
The opposite.
That's not true though. Like the extra two shares, if there's enough money to be gotten out there from ESPN or whatever, then they're willing to split up. You could still make more if they feel like adding, if ESPN what? Felt like adding these two teams, there's still more money out there.
Yes, I agree that if they felt that adding the two teams would create enough additional value that it would offset it,
but
then you would expand. But they don't
value.
Feel that way.
They don't feel that way because the best fucking team is in Oklahoma City. They're going to be looking at a championship.
That doesn't make any, you keep making these arguments and they don't make
There's
any sense.
There's not a fan base.
If the
How
problem,
are you not seeing that?
If having a team in Seattle made the NBA as a whole more valuable than the amount you're splitting up, then they would expand.
No, the problem is that they already have themselves in a bad position. And these people aren't necessarily thinking
just,
logically long-term about
circles,
it.
And we're not doing this anymore.
You Wow. Okay.
This is every podcast. You just repeat these arguments,
but
even though I rebut them.
Tell me, what is the problem? Why is
the
this
problem
not
is
happening?
Actually probably that they're not desperate enough right now.
Who's not desperate enough?
The owners. Because
aren't
again,
desperate enough for current instant cash?
Yes. That's what expansion is. Expansion is like borrowing against the value of your house.
Yeah, no, I understand that. So you feel like the yeah. owners are too wealthy currently.
They don't think it's going to add enough for them to make up for the long-term cost. And I think there are a lot of owners who would probably, who large market owners who say, why are we expanding when we should just move teams from smaller markets to larger ones?
Yeah.
So I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, because the actually keep moving the Sonics to Oklahoma City has been extraordinarily successful at moving, preventing other teams from moving in the future. The NBA has gone longer without a move than at any point in the history of the league.
I mean, that's also, there's a difference in the climate has changed over time. It's not just because of that. That was going to happen either way.
I mean, probably. But
that's great.
MLB team is moving. NFL teams, as you noted, just moved recently. The NBA has gone way longer without a franchise move than
that's
any
not,
other big four sport.
Well, how about this? Maybe that's not a sign of a healthy league. Maybe
I don't think
concerned
it's the lack of interest.
But it's the NFL is not doing bad. The NFL didn't, the teams didn't move to LA. There's a lot of movement among NFL teams, and it is by far the healthiest league financially. So you can't exactly point to it as like, well, unhealthy league, teams are moving. They've had tons of teams move, right?
I think you can definitely point to lots of teams moving as a sign of instability in the league.
So you think the NFL is instable because
No,
the
I think
Chargers
the NFL
moved?
Had a unique situation where the nation's second biggest market was without a team for 20 plus years. I just don't think that's really a fair comparison
but
to anything
still, like
else.
The Raiders moving from Oakland to Vegas, you know, like that's
I mean,
another
I guess,
one.
I guess
happened.
I can't point to MLB moving from Oakland to Las Vegas if it didn't happen in the NFL as well. Precisely the same move.
I think you are underestimating the value that the league would have of having stars in more marketable places. And I think the NBA was probably very pleased with the deal that happened a couple weeks ago. Overall.
That's why Kevin Durant struggled famously for attention when he played in Oklahoma City.
Kevin Durant became a lot more famous after.
I mean, he played for a team that won a bunch of championships. The Thunder like, didn't. The Thunder didn't not win championships because of their market size. They didn't win championships because they cheaped out at the wrong time and then spent the money on the wrong people.
Yeah, cheaped out at the wrong time also is a problem with having a team in a smaller market. You're not guaranteed those things. No team from Seattle would cheap out. Don't burn yourself.
It's time for your return of
we're going
your favorite segment.
It. Okay.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at ya.
Well, it is finally here, folks. Everyone has reported to camp in Peoria, not just pitchers and catchers. And if you're squinting just hard enough, you could see the signs of spring coming. There is a 60-degree and sunny day forecasted in Seattle, Washington, within the next 2 weeks. Blooms are starting to pop up on my cherry trees. I'm telling everyone this Mariners team has no holes. The last bits of snow have melted, even Marco's giant snowball. Because you know Mariners hot takes are back for the 2025 season. And this year, they will be about the same level of hot as ever. But we needed this, people. Coming after this winter, we need baseball more than any person, any country has ever needed baseball. And by God, it is going to be good in Seattle, Washington, because I look around at this Mariners team and I see not a wild card, not the division, but a pennant in sight. If you listen to some of the naysayers over the offseason, those who deliver hot takes for clicks, you'd feel like this team was awful. But instead, the numbers, the true baseball gods, see a different story. Across almost all projection systems, they see the Mariners as close to or the best team in the AL West. They see a team that after the Randy Arozarena trade last summer had a winning percentage of 55%, which projected over a full season would have gotten them to 89 wins, one better than the Houston Astros, who, oh, by the way, just casually in February, lost a 5-win player and one of the remaining centerpieces of their lineup unceremoniously to a team that will be competing for the wild card. Not against the Mariners, though. Instead of subtraction this offseason, despite what these so-called pundits may say, the Mariners stood pat. They made their moves last season and picked up my favorite player on offense. This ball player has four names, and they're all so sweet. Mantle, Bonds, Ruth. Well, the Mariners picked up regression to the mean. Don't you love how it sounds? So supple. Because I look at this lineup, and I see a lot of regression out there, baby. Julio, Garver, Polanco, a healthy Crawford. Pair that with a pitching staff who are young and deep enough to withstand injury. A bullpen dipping their pen into some of that sweet, sweet regression as well. And I asked these yahoos on the internet why they were so desperate to trade a member of the best staff in baseball. Because if you ask me, if you're a hater, just wait. But for the Mariners, you're going to have to wait a long time, big boy, because this team has no holes and a whole lot of youth right behind it. Woo! We are so back. So back.
Is it really a Mariners season before Tristan has said there are no holes on the team? I mean, my favorite part of this whole, like, we've needed this is the idea that the Mariners playing games. No one is going to be unhappy at any point when that happens.
Needed baseball. We need baseball more than anything. You can't feel it. You can feel that we need baseball. What, are you going to debate some of my points?
Well, regression to the mean, I thought was my favorite offensive player. It is funny though, you pointed out it having four names and then the greats that are all identifiable by one name.
Although regression, I suppose, is
regression is too. The projections are pretty optimistic. I think the Mariners are going to be pretty good. I think the rest of the AL West.
ESPN's Kevin Pelton coming in hot. Pretty good.
I'm grading the Mariners of solid B+ going into the season.
There we go.
Matt Brash threw his first bullpen session on Saturday since the Tommy John surgery. So that was
we needed Brash moment. Like we needed baseball. We're all counting on Matt Brash.
I'm hearing that as the good luck. We're all counting on you. From
I would say the whole season probably rides on Matt Brash.
We officially said farewell to Justin Turner on this week as he signed with the Cubs for $6 million over 1 year.
I'm a little surprised the Mariners didn't bring back Justin Turner for 1 year, $6 million, but
I mean, I feel like to some degree, probably
from Seattle would be cheap.
Yes. Some degree, I think probably just roster spots at some point became the issue rather than money. I mean, money was an issue, but like just people are penciling in a lot of guys for the bench for the Mariners, and you don't keep very many hitters there, especially if two of those guys are named Mitch and they happen to have very large guaranteed contracts, which, you know, they could just cut Mitch Haniger. Garver is a backup
catcher.
Garver's
coming back.
Would not really make sense. You're not going to be able to improve on that roster spot, but I think we'll believe that one with Mitch Haniger when I see it.
I did not include him in my regression to the mean list.
Oh, no. Oh, poor Machaniger.
The mean may have changed.
Look, Machaniger, so
we'll
important.
See. We could be wrong. We could be wrong. Mariners. I legitimately was like, I thought Victor Robles was just a player. I thought he was going to be Terrence Stansbury. You know what I mean?
It's definitely all a new sentence in the history of the English language. I thought that Victor Robles.
The New York Times. First ever said in the New York Times.
But this is the beauty of spring, right? You know, it's sunny and warm in Peoria.
Somewhere.
Everyone is coming into the season relatively healthy. There's a lot of optimism. And then you play the games. And sometimes you lose them. Anything else on the Mariners here?
I can't freaking wait. I'm so excited. It's happening. We've got baseball across the board. It's happening everywhere. College baseball started.
They play spring training games this weekend. I think we discussed that previously, but now I don't remember.
That doesn't sound right.
No, I think they do. Yeah, Friday at 12:10 p.m. Mariners and their Peoria neighbors, the San Diego Padres, the baseball's fiercest rivalry.
There we go. Wow, so, Friday.
Here we go.
It felt like January was the longest month of my entire life, and it just kept going. And February has gone by relatively fast, partially because it was all snow days for children. And that means we're that much closer to baseball. What day is opening day?
That's a great question. It's gone by fast for me as well, because I spent half of it in Hawaii. So that was nice.
Well, good for you. No, you actually is like, you literally lost days to trade deadline.
But it went fast.
Yeah, no, I'm saying.
It went fast.
Yeah. Wake up, B+, B+, B+.
Oh, so no, little so many B pluses, so little time. When is Mariners opening day? March 27th.
Whoa, it's kind of an early one.
Sacramento Athletics.
Whoa, that's a weird name. What an unhealthy league.
You're declaring that they are a healthy league?
Baseball? I think baseball is a healthier league than basketball right now.
No, by no means are they. Okay, well, check out the next TV deal and you get back to me after that one gets signed.
But they have very large local TV deals in a way that basketball doesn't. It's a different
distribution. Well, that's a sustainable business model.
It's about, baseball is about playing 160 games and you watch all of them. Basketball is about, like,
I agree that's the business model. It works great for the Dodgers and the Yankees and maybe the Mets. In all the other markets, including Seattle, where I don't know if you heard, the collapse of the local TV deal was a big factor in why the team didn't spend more money last year.
People are still going to pay money to watch these games.
Okay.
The setup is different. They just haven't gotten to the next part yet. It's like when Napster killed
but
music
the next
and then all of a sudden Spotify
profitable.
Figured it out. It was. It's just that if there is a means that people want to see, right? If there is an event that people want to see, they are going to pay for that.
But people, not as many people want to see it because people don't care about watching things live the same way.
I do not agree with that at all.
Mm. What? How much TV do your children watch? How many Mariners games does Baby Fantasy Genius watch?
How many?
How much YouTube?
8-year-old.
Baby Fantasy Genius? Luca, I feel like consumes more. I bet he consumes more baseball on YouTube than he does.
He watches almost no baseball on YouTube. Not a fan of the sport.
Oh, really?
To be honest. Children don't watch baseball. Are you kidding me? But
no,
also,
but like,
they don't watch basketball either.
I agree with that. I think that all pro sports might be in trouble, other than football.
They're not in trouble. It's just the structure is changing. This idea that they're in trouble, it doesn't have to be.
I mean, they're not gonna
at
fold.
The same, when people are like, they're in trouble, they don't need to be the same volume of billion-dollar business. Businesses can scale
See,
up and down.
That's where, again, you don't forget. You're forgetting that capitalism does not like
but,
that.
But
capitalism
they
is
don't
all
go
about
away.
Growth.
They don't disappear.
I'm
I understand that capitalism
disappear.
Is all about growth.
I'm saying that people are going to be unhappy.
Sure. People can be unhappy, and the thing that they should be unhappy with is having the fucking teams in Oklahoma. That's the thing they should be unhappy with, because they still, at the end of the day, have a whole arena that they have to sell tickets to. They have to play games and have
fans
in their local market.
Struggle to sell tickets?
I do think that the Thunder have... How famous do you think Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is?
Shai Gilgeous-Alexander isn't famous because he's Canadian.
That is not true. First off, he's not an interesting player to watch. But second off...
Well, this is a preposterous take.
Well, he plays for a certain team. I'm not exactly going to be giving to him. But I just don't find him to be that interesting of a player. But second off, he doesn't play in a place that he's...
Again, Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook played there.
Are the most famous athletes on earth. Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook are the most famous athletes on earth.
Among the most famous athletes on earth. Do you know
Marshawn Lynch? First off, Russell Westbrook wouldn't even win an Emmy. Okay?
I'm not arguing their acting prowess.
I think Kevin Durant is famous, but there is a level of fame that he achieved. And it was bigger. It was greater.
Of course, because he was in the NBA Finals.
Yeah, but Jalen Brunson, how much better is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander than Jalen Brunson?
Is your argument that Jalen Brunson is famous? Because I've got some bad news for you.
Miss than SGA.
You know that Jalen Brunson finished like fourth in fan voting for the All-Star game, and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander finished... I think he finished ahead of Steph Curry. I'm pretty sure he was number one in West backcourt. This is just a bizarre hill to die on.
And that NBA teams should be in Seattle instead of Oklahoma City. It's a bizarre hill not to die on.
Certainly, Seattle is a much bigger market. All right, Seattle Kraken. Return to action on Saturday with a 3-game Southeast road trip to Florida, Tampa.
Top selling NBA jerseys. This is people putting money that matters, not fan vote. Number one, Stephen Curry. Number two, LeBron James. Number three, Jason Tatum. Number four, Jalen Brunson.
That's interesting. I don't think it means as much as you think it does.
It means that people are spending money on this. And it also means that SGA, he's number 11. It's nice. Your most famous person on the earth, Kevin Durant's number 13. But Jalen Brunson is the worst of those players. Is he not? Number five is Wemby.
He's still like a top 10 player in the league. I don't know. All right, well, another team is kicking off action. And they're kicking off for real on Wednesday night. Seattle Sounders playing in CONCACAF Champions Cup against Antigua in Guatemala.
Is this Wednesday, February 19th or the following week?
Wednesday, February 19th.
Okay.
The day this podcast is coming out. Antigua qualified as a semifinalist in the Central American Cup, having previously reached the CONCACAF champion stage, only once losing in the group stage in 2017, back when it was the Champions League. They're currently tied for second in Guatemala's Liga Nacional. The return match will be played next Wednesday in Seattle. So we'll know pretty quickly if the Sounders are going to advance in the first of the several additional competitions besides the MLS regular season they're playing. Sounders hoping to have Albert Rushnak, who returned to full training Monday after tweaking his quadricep during a friendly against Hammarby. Brian Schmetzer told reporters, quote, he's got a good shot of being fully available. Then coming up on Saturday, Sounders open the MLS regular season at home against Charlotte. Sounders open number four in the MLSsoccer.com power rankings after losing in last year's conference championship. Charlotte has moved up to eighth after adding Cote d'Ivoire winger Wilfried Zaha as a designated player this offseason. So he'll be making his debut against the Sounders. Sounders did make an important roster move leading up to the start of the season as they traded Josh Atencio to the Colorado Rapids for $1.3 million general allocation money, plus up to $300,000 additional GAM based on performance metrics. Atencio joined the Sounders as a homegrown product in 2020 at age 18, made 27 appearances across all competitions in 2021, really looked like a key part of the Sounders' future, but fell behind Obed Vargas in the midfield depth chart and then had moved to center back during the preseason, where he didn't project as a regular contributor this season with the Sounders' depth there. So in an opportunity to get him more playing time in Colorado, perhaps in his more natural position in the midfield, and then for the Sounders to get one of the larger valuations we've ever seen in terms of general allocation money in a move like this within MLS. Not dramatically different than what they gave up to get Jesus Ferreira and Paul Areola from SC Dallas, is much more accomplished players this offseason. So here we go. We'll have Sounders games to talk about, a couple of them next week.
I'm going to match February 26th, whatever, the following Wednesday.
Oh, so you are going to the Antigua match.
Okay. Yeah. You probably said that. I was reading about top-selling NBA merchandise. I'm sure you said those words. Do you think that in the top 10, do you think that the best team in the league is in the top 10?
Well, no. If Shea isn't in the top 10, then obviously they're not.
By team.
Oh, in the top 10 by team? I don't know. Probably not. No.
Absolutely not. Not to be heard from.
I think it'll be different next year.
Why?
Because they'll probably make a much deeper playoff run than they did last year.
When the Holmgren sauce happens? Like, come on. The Bulls are not a good team, but they're number five.
I agree that market size matters. I'm not disputing that market size matters. What you're saying is that it matters to, like, if the Bulls are number five, they're not the number five because, like, having a great player on the Bulls or not wouldn't make a difference. It's just people in Chicago got to buy jerseys.
But yeah, people in Seattle would buy more jerseys.
I agree. Again, I'm not disputing.
People in Seattle would watch more games.
But people in Seattle are still watching games. They haven't completely turned out the NBA, as it turns out.
People in Oklahoma would still watch games.
The marginal difference just less is not, again, no one is saying the NBA would not be better off with a team in Seattle. I'm just disputing the idea that the NBA, like, concerns that exist about the relative future position of the NBA are related to this one specific franchise.
But it's... I agree that it's probably not that great, but they still have it structured wrong. And they used one team as a sacrifice to continue the one specific point that they had. It didn't help them in the other aspects, though. And I'm saying that the other things that matter are having marketable stars and bigger markets. That's what makes the TV deals bigger.
I also think you underestimate the difference between, yes, Chicago is an enormous city. LA and New York are enormous cities. That's true. Seattle is not on that level. Seattle is closer to Oklahoma City than it is to Chicago and LA and New York.
But I do think, like, Milwaukee and Minnesota are higher because they, and Dallas. Dallas is a big, big city. They're higher
Seattle
because
is
they
in
have
the same range as those cities.
Yeah, but Oklahoma City isn't. They are a tier lower than all those. Seattle is in the same range as Milwaukee. They're bigger than Milwaukee, I think. But. Yes. In the same range as Minnesota, as Minneapolis, basically. That's where the team should go. Anthony Edwards is not as good of a player as Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. He's a more interesting player than Shai Gilgeous is. But Anthony Edwards is not as good of a player, and he is very high in these jersey sales.
I think you're over-indexing on the jersey sales, which is not something that I look at that closely as a measure of player popularity. It's also like the Thunder have trash jerseys is the other thing.
It's just a slap together franchise. But Anthony Edwards is a more marketable star in Minneapolis than SGA is in Oklahoma City.
I mean, probably, but Anthony Edwards is also like a great personality who, again, plays for the U.S. Olympic team. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander doesn't get to play in the Olympic gold medal game.
Do you think that matters that much? They're just like, well, I don't even know who this person is. If you tell me that it's a national sport, people can't even figure out who he is. Which one is it?
I'm saying people are very jingoistic.
That's not it.
Oh, especially in 2025.
Of the top 10,
so all
there
other
are
things equal.
Three players who are not, or four players who are not American. Like, I mean, this probably is a worldwide thing, and maybe it's boosted.
And again,
because of...
Shai Gilgeous-Alexander finished ahead of Steph Curry in All-Star voting.
I just don't all-star vote. What is all-star voting? Where does it happen? People just vote for all-star voting based upon who they think it should be. I don't really buy the all-star. There's a difference between clicking a button or whatever and spending money. Spending money is the actual thing that matters.
I just think jerseys sales are too dependent on, is it a new jersey that the team has introduced? Is the player on a new team? Things like
Steph
this.
Curry?
Like, you're not...
LeBron James?
Yeah, I'm aware
Jason Tatum?
Again, No one is arguing whether Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is going to be as popular as those guys.
But I just don't really.
The question
agree
is him versus
argument.
Anthony Edwards.
Well, Ant is higher. Like, what? He? Do they have new jerseys? Ant's been around for a while.
They have very nice. I don't know what the names of the alternates are.
I mean, you also should have good franchises as well. But, like, the reality is, if I see that team on TV, unless they're playing the Lakers, I'm probably not watching because I'm not interested in them. They're just not.
You don't think that you overall. Personally. You think you personally are representative of the media?
I like to. I would like to go out of my way to watch them because I want to cheer against them. I have more of a vested interest in them than I do almost any other team. Also, the Suns. Good God, I never want to watch the Suns again. I'm deeply uninterested in watching that team.
Seattle Reign FC, BFC, 1-0 Sunday in a friendly at the Coachella Valley Invitational in their preseason debut, with Lynn Biondolo scoring the lone goal in her first Reign appearance. Biondolo, among six Reign players now headed on international duty. Without them, the Reign will face Angel City in Coachella Valley Saturday. That one's at 12 noon. We'll be on Fox 13 Plus. All right, so since we last recorded, the Seattle Storm did basically like the entire offseason. We obviously had the Jewel Lloyd trade previously. We knew that Neko Ogwumike was going to re-sign, had a pretty good feeling that Gabby Williams was going to re-sign, but have done a lot to fill out their roster that since then. Most notably, bringing back our old friend Alicia Clark on a one-year contract in free agency. This one was really important. There was a press conference Tuesday with Noel Quinn and Talisa Ray, Rhea, the Storm's lead decision makers, and Noel Quinn mentioned that they had been pursuing Alicia Clark from the start of free agency, bringing her back, adding her, you know, leadership and experience as a three-time WNBA champion. And the other thing is, if you looked at it, it's the same thing I went through in the WNBA mock off season, although it was actually with Dallas in that mock off season rather than Seattle because I had already spent my money.
You hate the city of Seattle.
After you got past Alicia Clark, the free agent wings, there was a pretty considerable drop off in terms of talent and experience and shooting, which is something that, you know, the Storm really needed and that Alicia Clark brings. So really huge for them. This was, you know, a lot of interest out there in Alicia Clark. Obviously, Vegas would have loved to bring her back after she won the championship there in 2023. But instead, she is returning to Seattle. And now looks like it could potentially be, you know, depending on how the draft falls, in a starting role, because one of the unfortunate bits of news that's happened since we last recorded is Jordan Horston suffered an ACL tear playing in the Athletes Unlimited League. So she will be out the entire 2025 season. So you look, you know, fortunately, Gabby Williams and Alicia Clark are two players who bring a lot of the same skills that Jordan Horston did and can play a variety of different positions. And that's something the Storm are going to need.
Okay. So after these moves, how are we feeling about the Storm roster overall? Obviously, Alicia Clark being a big signing.
Well, let's talk through a few of the smaller moves they made as well. They signed Erica Wheeler, veteran WNBA point guard, to a training camp contract. Says non-guaranteed for 1 year at the minimum. Then they invited a handful of players, Zaya Cook, to most notably to training camp. They signed Mackenzie Holmes, who they drafted last year in the third round, knowing that she was going to be unable to play her first year due to injury. And then they made a trade with LA, their second trade of the offseason with the Sparks, to get Lexi Brown, who is a big-time three-point shooter, really, again, helps that need for shooting so long as she can stay on the court. She's missed extensive time in the past two seasons while trying to manage. In 2023, it was undiagnosed Crohn's disease. She got that diagnosis during the last off season and was able to start the 2024 season, but then was unfortunately not able to finish it. She is back on the court now, also playing in that Athletes Unlimited League where Alicia Clark is playing too. So, you know, Storm really, I think, hopeful that they can manage this and she can manage this and stay healthy and help them quite a bit. So you look at it, I think your core right now, you've got Skylar Diggins-Smith, Alicia Clark, Gabby Williams, Neko Ogwumike, Ezi Magbegor. Those at this point, pending what happens with the number two pick in the draft, are probably going to be your five starters and your five key players. Then, you know, in terms of depth, you've got Erica Wheeler, as we mentioned, at point guard. Lexi Brown at shooting guard, gives them some minutes. Li Yiru, who they picked up in that LA trade along with the number two pick, is a backup center, giving them some size there. And still then some question marks beyond that, because you don't have Jordan Horston in the mix, is a versatile contributor off the bench. They do still have at least about $100,000 to spend in free agency. So we'll see who or what else they end up adding. A name to watch, I think, is Katie Lou Samuelson, who was here in the 2021 season. Then they traded her to get Gabby Williams. Katie Lou was in Indiana last season. They reached a buyout agreement last week, so she's going to become an unrestricted free agent. And someone else who would provide some shooting in the Storm have a real history of bringing in players who get bought out by Indiana. They previously did it with both Jantel Lavender and then last season Victoria Vivians. They've also signed a couple. Wheeler, a former Fever player, and then Candace Dupree going back before that. So they've really liked the Indiana to Seattle connection. It'll be interesting to see if Katie Lou might be the next player to follow that path.
Interesting. So it does feel like the bench is pretty brand new overall, right?
Oh yeah, and we knew that was going to be the case.
Relatively similar, but it's a roster that the depth is going to be new to Seattle. So how do we feel about this team overall then?
So much of it still depends on that number two pick, I think. And Paige Becker has told reporters she still plans to enter the WNBA draft not long ago. You know, we'll see whether she, you know, expresses any question about whether that's in Dallas and, you know, whether that allows Seattle to potentially trade into that number one spot. Olivia Miles continues playing very well for Notre Dame, had 8 threes, I think, over the weekend. Notre Dame's now the number one team in the country. So, you know, she and Paige Beckers both declare she probably looks like the number two prospect, but definitely.
Let's
keep
say
an
it's
eye.
Olivia Miles. Is how does the roster look? Ignoring Paige Beckers, let's say it's Olivia Miles. They can control their destiny, so to say.
I think you're looking at them somewhere probably in the same range as last season, maybe in that 5th through 7th range, maybe up to 4th is kind of an upside.
Which is not bad considering they'll have gotten younger.
Right. It's interesting because, you know, Alicia Clark, one of the older players in the league at this point in her career, but, and, you know, Neko Gwumike and Skylar Diggins-Smith as veterans as well. Having that number two pick in place, you know, one of the things that Talisa Rhea said during the press conference was, you know, this is someone who can help us now, win now and in the future with that number two pick. So, UW women's basketball. Since we last recorded, they got an important road win at Penn State on February 5th, 82-71, but have lost their last three, including a pair of heartbreakers in the past week. Last Wednesday in Eugene, both those games, by the way, they led heading into the fourth quarter. Last Wednesday in Eugene, Hannah Steins gave the Huskies a 67-65 lead in the final minute, but Deja Kelly made 3 free throws to put the Ducks back in front, and Devin Coppinger missed a possible winner as they lost 68-67. Then on Sunday at home against USC, a 13-2 run put the Huskies up 13 late in the third quarter, but the Trojans closed the period with an 8-0 run and took the lead for good with 3:12 remaining as they went on to beat the Huskies 69-64. Huskies still have only one quad one win, and they really would love to add to that. Beating USC would have been an enormous victory to add to that resume, but still the last team in, according to ESPN's bracketology, right there on the bubble.
I mean, that's as far as losses go, that's a huge loss that they
Correct.
Had.
It goes with you know, the narrow loss to LSU in the preseason tournament, that they've shown that they can play with anyone in the country this season. It's just finishing off one of these upsets that they haven't been able to do.
Where are they ranked according to Bart Torvik right now?
42nd.
Okay. So they statistically probably should be in.
Right there on the bubble.
Yeah.
A must-win Thursday against a Rutgers team that is battling just to make the Big Ten tournament at 2-13. Only Purdue, who the Huskies blew out at home, is rated worse in the conference by Bart Torvik. And then an opportunity to get what would be a pretty big road win at Nebraska against a Cornhuskers team that's 8-7 in big play, but just 2 spots higher on Bart Torvik. So a very winnable game for the Huskies. UW men's basketball, since we last recorded, lost at home to Nebraska in a game I had on in the background while I was doing trade grades.
Wow, that was a while ago.
It was a while ago. Then
That game, I just going back a second, because times have changed since then. I think I underestimated how good that Nebraska team is. And now looking at it, I'm like, all right, this wasn't a bad loss. But I think they were up 12 at the half.
Yeah.
And just really whimpered their way to the end. And that was the game.
Very unsustainable three-point shooting first half.
I was out. I was like, you know what? It's been a nice season, guys. I'll see you later. I'm going to head out for the season.
So you missed their big win that Saturday against Northwestern at home.
I paid actually no attention to that one. I just glanced at it and I was like, all right, well.
I paid no attention to their 93-69 loss last Wednesday at Ohio State, but did watch on Saturday as they went to State College and beat
that
Penn
is the
State
one where
75-73.
They got
you back.
In. They pulled me back in on that one.
Just when you thought you were out.
The Ohio State loss, I was like, oh, that was the door was almost closed behind me. But Penn State coming back. I do love that the thing that we're targeting that I'm watching is just making the tournament. It's all about whatever your goals are.
The Big Ten tournament.
Yeah, the Big Ten tournament. Because that is, at this point, that would be a successful season.
I think someone compared it on the Discord to like avoiding relegation at the end of the
season.
Yeah,
it's what it feels like. It really is what it feels like. Is you don't want to be part of the three teams that don't make the tournament. And I think that would be preseason. I don't know if that would be a successful season. Where we're at right now, that would be a successful season for this UW team.
I recall back when we were recording in October or November, you were shocked to find out that the Huskies, I think at that point, were like 17th in KenPom in the Big Ten. Maybe 16th. Well, so yeah, I think finishing in the top 15 would actually be a fairly impressive accomplishment.
I think I was expecting a little bit. I was expecting Great to be, obviously, you know, not having seen him before this. You know, I don't remember paying attention to Great Osabor before, but I was expecting him to be a slightly different player than he is. And I think he has become, since Frank Kepnong has been back, a little bit of that player. I thought his finishing would be a little stronger. I thought he would be a little bit better, a little bit more dynamic of an offensive player. And they'd get a little bit more from their rotating cast of shooting guard small forwards or whatever.
I actually think they've gotten a fair amount from them. I mean,
in the end, I think they have. It's just always been different, and it's never really been kind of consistent. I don't think they've put it together as far as a handful of games against good teams. The main reason that I just want it to feel good at the end of the year is so that they can try to maintain in this transfer portal era some sort of good vibes in the program heading to the offseason. We know who's almost certainly going to be gone. Being able to keep Zoom around, it'll depend on money, probably first and foremost, but it'll depend on how he feels at the end of the season and how he feels about the season overall. There probably will be people who are willing to pay him more over the offseason, but is it worth it to stay home for slightly less? And obviously the Great money opening up does mean that there's a little bit of extra money. They're going to be in the portal as well, though. They're going to have to fill out the rest of the roster. So, but can they maintain a couple of the players that they've built a little something with this year, add to the recruiting class that Danny Sprinkle has coming in, and really look at being a team that, you know, in the Nebraska range next year, right? I don't want to get too ahead of myself, but can they be in the middle of the pack in the Big Ten next year? It's not an easy conference to do it in.
I mean, to me, Mekhi Mason has been that guy out of the pack. Like, as you said, it's not necessarily consistent. He had 2 points in 21 minutes at Ohio State.
No, there were games
and scored 20
Mason's
against Penn State.
Absolutely non-existent. But yeah, I mean, obviously this weekend was great.
It's interesting that, like, as well as Frank Kepnong has played, the Huskies' KenPom ranking has not moved at all since he debuted. But a very interesting Great Osabor game on Saturday. 6 points on 2 of 7 shooting, but had 10 assists and 13 rebounds. It was the first rebound assist double-double in the Big Ten in several years.
I mean, it's incredible that the reason he didn't get there was points, yep. And that is not a thing you would have ever expected. I was a little shocked by that one. But also keeping Tyler Harris around, I think, is important as well. I think it's Zoom and Tyler Harris. That's kind of what I care about.
Mekhi Mason would be a solid number three for me, but yeah, I think those are the two biggest priorities given just their age. And
it's also an older team overall too. I mean, there's almost nobody else who can be back.
I mean, Breidenbach is out of eligibility. Yeah, I think that is pretty close to it, isn't it?
As far as players who are contributing, And I think that was part of the reason that I thought the team would be a little bit better this year, just because they are, you know, like DJ Davis is older, Mason's older, Great's older, Iheanacho's older. It's funny, I think Louis Cortwright's just gone from the team now, but
well, he is suspended right now.
But he's also older. Brian Bach is like, it's not a young team.
They're 54th in experience nationally when weighted by minutes played, according to Ken Palm.
And that's being dragged down quite a bit, probably just because of Zoom, I would assume.
Yeah. Zoom, you would assume. So the Huskies are currently 16th in the Big Ten standings. They have tiebreakers over both of the teams behind them after the last 2 weeks. The Minnesota tiebreaker no longer looking quite as valuable after the Golden Gophers improbably swept their road trip to the LA school.
They won today?
Yeah.
Minnesota?
I watched the first half of that one, or was following the first half of that one. I was shocked
when I was watching.
They won 64-61 at UCLA after winning 69-66 at USC.
Remember when we were back in the Pac-12? You remember that?
I do. I'm old enough to remember that.
It was always like all of these Pac-12 teams just beat up on each other. Nobody can be that good because everybody just beats everybody else. And then you get to the Big Ten, and it's almost like it's exactly the same. And you look at
but the difference is like some of the teams still rank really highly.
Exactly. In the Big Ten, they've won non-conference games sometimes.
Right.
And so the teams still appear good even though they do that. But I do think it's interesting looking at the Big Ten standings. I was thinking of the team from down south who had probably real aspirations this season, and now I would guess are probably not in the tournament right now.
They're still 35 on Ken Palm.
Are they?
They are, yeah. I'm looking at it right now.
You know, they're under 500 in conference, but, you know, aside from a couple of teams at the top, that middle tier is, you know, Minnesota is able to sweep the LA schools randomly, whereas UCLA before then was one of the better teams in conference. And that's just a thing that happens.
Yeah, Oregon's an 8 seed. They're fine.
Really?
Yeah. The conference is really good. It's fine to be below 500 when you're in this conference.
Wow.
I just blew your mind.
They lost 1, 2, 3. They lost 5 in a row. And it wasn't necessarily to great teams.
Yeah, but you started out as like a 3 seed, is what you're forgetting. So the Huskies have crucial tiebreakers to be decided this week. On Wednesday, they host Rutgers, who's a half game up in the standings at 5-10. Saturday, they travel to face Iowa, who's a game up at 5-9. Rutgers has some really good wins this season, UCLA, Illinois, at Nebraska, but losses at Kennesaw State, to Princeton, and at home to Iowa. Famously, they have 2 top 5 prospects in Dylan Harper and Ace Bailey, which is why, for the first time in several years, I will be heading out to Heck Ed to take this game in on Wednesday night. Bailey, a premier tough shot maker who also blocks shots well, he's going to be one of the more polarizing prospects, I think, in recent memory, because eye test, he is like the next Kevin Durant, and statistically, not exactly that. Dylan Harper, son of Ron Harper, a terrific finisher for a young guard. Good distributor, just a 32% three-point shooter, though. No other starter with an above-average usage rate. So the Rutgers really goes as these two freshmen go, and it'll be interesting to see how they handle the cauldron that is Heck Ed. Iowa star Peyton Sanford's having a down senior season, and he had a 608 true shooting percentage as a junior. Looked really good in my projections, but just 542 this season. Hawkeyes have also been hit hard by injuries. Starting center Owen Freeman had season-ending finger surgery. Guard Drew Thelwell has missed the last 2 games with an ankle injury. But they're still top 10 nationally in both effective field goal percentage and turnover rate. Guy to watch is wing Josh Dix, who's a 43% three-point shooter. But Iowa allowing the highest points per possession of any team in Big Ten play, including 59% on twos and 39% on threes. They started 12-4, but their lone wins since then are against Penn State and Rutgers. So there you go. Big week for the Huskies.
It's a must split at the very least.
I would say so, yeah. Well, for the first time, we will check in on UW softball results. They're 5-5 through 2 weekends of play. They beat host Arizona in the Chondrea Classic, but lost both matchups with Alabama, despite Alexis DeBoer homering against your dad's school. Last weekend, they lost to Grand Canyon and Arizona State in the Littlewood Classic. They are headed this weekend to the Mary Nutter Classic at the Cathedral City, California. We'll also play a one-off game next Monday at CSU Northridge. DeBoer tied for the team high so far as a freshman with 3 home runs. Oregon State transfer Charity Seva Atasi also has 3 home runs. Freshman Sophie Mazzola and Jaden Glab are both hit a team high at 357. Cal Poly transfer Sophia Ramuno has been the most effective pitcher with a 3-1 record, a 2.45 ERA. But freshman Morgan Reimer has gotten the bulk of the innings and faced, I think, tougher competition with a 2.86 ERA.
It's a rebuilding year, but the Alexis DeBoer home run, first home run coming against Alabama was awesome.
It was great to see come through on social.
And then just kind of what, you know, they're having to build everything. It's a very, very, very young team, so. It's not going to be the same UW softball team that I think we've gotten a little bit used to for the last handful of years.
Absolutely. All right, some more coaching and comings and goings for UW football. Linebacker coach Robert Bala is following Vinny Sinceri to become co-defensive coordinator and linebacker coach at Florida. The Huskies hired Brian Odom to replace him, amusing because Brian's brother Barry replaced UW defensive coordinator Ryan Walters as the head coach at Purdue. Walters and both Odoms actually overlapped at Missouri. Odom played at Oklahoma, coached there under Lincoln Riley before following Riley to USC. So he's got some recent experience playing against UW in this conference. And what was the same conference?
Was Brian Odom the defensive coordinator at USC?
No, he wasn't the defensive coordinator. He was under Alex Grinch. He was linebacker coach there. Okay. With no limits now to assistant coaches who don't have off-campus recruiting responsibilities, Huskies have staffed up, including a dedicated special teams coach and Chris Petrilli, who had held the same role at Purdue, and then hired J.P. Lossman as assistant QB coach. Lossman played for the Seahawks in 2010, a piece of information that I could not remember.
Yeah, I don't know if I remember. Marshall, I want to say. Is that right?
That sounds vaguely familiar.
Drafted,
I mean,
by
I mostly
the Bills,
think of him as the Bills,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a first-round pick by the Bills, if I remember correctly. And he was kind of huge.
No, now you're thinking of Josh Allen.
I think he was kind of a proto-Josh Allen.
Josh Allen before Josh Allen. But when he was with the Seahawks, you knew who the quarterback coach was for the Seahawks.
Was it Jed Fish?
It was Jed Fish.
There we go.
Tulane was where J.P. Lossman went.
Okay, it was a green school.
He's 6'2", 217. I wouldn't say he was notably large.
All right. For some reason, I remember him being pretty big.
Was eventually replaced by Trent Edwards, who's 6'4", so a little bigger.
Replaced by Trent Edwards. Oh, is Bill's quarterback?
Yeah. He had been at Oklahoma as assistant director of player personnel there. And this was news I know caught your eye. The athletics department hired UW alum Cameron Foster as senior director of contracts and cap management in preparation for the revenue sharing era in college sports. He will remain with the agency he founded, Rain Sports Management, where he's represented multiple Huskies, including several stars of recent vintage. So this is an interesting move. I mean, all colleges are sort of preparing for this new era of college sports. And this is a move I think that makes a lot of sense. Okay, I guess you didn't take note.
No, I did take note. I mean, we talked about it.
On the Discord?
Yeah, and I think it's a good decision overall to start, you know, beefing up this part of the department. Absolutely. It is funny. The recent trend of assistant coaches across all sports, and I think people treat it like there's a value in it. And it's probably just a net neutral overall. I mean, there's a value for the coaches to be hired, but the amount of coaches that...
Toward more assistant coaches?
What?
Toward more assistant coaches? Is this what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, you look at an NBA bench and you're just like, they got people in rows upon rows. Like, they're not able to sell as many courtside seats anymore because of how many assistant coaches are involved in an NBA team. Or you look at the Husky basketball team and it's like, there's like 7 assistant coaches or something like that. And it's kind of like, it's a reminder that the money is endless. All of this is a reminder that the money is endless. It's not like they're getting paid massive amounts of money, but hiring people isn't cheap to do. And the fact that these teams are doing this is like, it's just, it keeps going. It goes on and on and on.
Well, I didn't know this. I'm looking at J.P. Lossman's Wikipedia. He's from L.A. and originally was at UCLA, but transferred to Tulane after being told he would not be the starting quarterback. Unclear who he was competing with from this Wikipedia page.
At UCLA in what year?
This would be
1999.
Yeah.
So it's post Cade McNown, but not by that much.
Right. I mean, I'm sure we can find this information. It's not that hard to find.
They weren't very good in 1999, so.
Corey Paz.
Oh, yeah, Corey Paz.
Another old friend. There you go. Or Casey, I guess, was our old friend.
That's in the year 2000?
No, 99.
99.
Drew Bennett was also there. What did...
I was going to say Drew Bennett is what I'm saying. They beat UW in overtime. I kind of remember that game.
Who ended up moving to wide receiver?
I think I remember being frustrated by this loss in 1999.
I mean, I'm sure you were.
It was Tui, and
that was the year that they got knocked out of the Rose Bowl
because of that loss.
Yeah, and Tyrone Willingham and Stanford ended up going to the Rose Bowl and facing Wisconsin. I want to say Ron Dane, but I don't know if that's quite the right era.
I think it is Troy Walters, right?
Yeah,
Troy Walters was the star of Stanford.
There you go. All right, a little bit of Seahawks news on the coaching side as well. They hired Justin Otten as run game specialist and assistant O-line coach, and Rick Dennison is run game coordinator and senior offensive advisor. Both have ties to new OC Clint Kubiak. Dennison's association with Gary Kubiak goes back to their time as Broncos teammates in the 1980s. Began his career as an offensive assistant in Denver, was Kubiak's OC in Houston and Denver, then spent last season as a senior offensive assistant for the Saints with Clint Kubiak. Otten linked up with Kubiak in Denver as offensive coordinator under Nathaniel Hackett in 2022, when Kubiak served as quarterback coach and passing game coordinator. Hackett called plays for the season's first 9 games. Then Kubiak called them for the next 6. And after Hackett was fired, and then Otten took over the play calling for the last 2 weeks of that season. He was then fired along with the rest of the coaching staff and spent the last 2 years with the Titans, holding the run game coordinator title and coaching running backs 1 season, tight ends most recently. Cool.
Like a long TikTok where I saw where it's like, the Seahawks take a page out of college with what they're doing right now. And I was just like, you might be thinking too hard about this one. I was just like, maybe we need baseball to argue about, because this ain't it. Talking about this is just fine.
I mean, I think what's interesting is now you've got multiple people on the offensive staff with offensive coordinator experience. You went from having no one with any NFL offensive coordinator experience last year in Ryan Grubb's first year to suddenly having inexperienced NFL offensive coordinator in Clint Kubiak, plus a couple of other former offensive coordinators to assist him.
Great. I'm going to boldly predict that either matters a lot or doesn't matter at all, but it's probably going to end up about the same, and the offense will be probably slightly better than they were the previous year just because of regression. I think all of this is like, yeah.
I am looking forward to Griffin Pulliam mocking up in the Discord jersey of regression to the mean.
This, like, the idea that we're supposed to spend this much time being concerned with the Seahawks run game coordinator, and I'm like,
I mean, look, there's a...
We need baseball, is what you're saying.
I suppose on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
You wanted to talk SNL?
Yeah.
Did you watch the whole 50th anniversary special?
I have watched the whole 50th anniversary special.
I fell off. I was watching with children who, like, it's so complex. They don't know who famous people are. This might go back to your point about people not, wow, we're doing a post podcast where we could reference the previous things that happened.
Oh, it's almost like that's a good idea.
But
the producers told me that was a good idea.
There are more than one producer now.
You said that, didn't you?
The producers. But like, they don't know who famous people are. So they're like, who's that? And I'm like, that's Conan O'Brien over there. That's Steven Spielberg or whatever. And they have no idea who the fuck these people are. The idea, like, they might know the movies that Steven Spielberg directed, but it's not like they know the director of the movies. So it's a little bit complicated watching with children. Also, the amount of sketches that are self-referential to previous SNL sketches, it's kind of like...
So all of them?
Yeah, you have to know. Like, I felt like the barrier to entry for it was quite high. But I'm always down for Black Jeopardy.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, that's these anniversary specials are for people who have watched it and know it inside and out. The people who are like,
do you feel
hey,
like that's the case, though? Because it's kind of strange.
I mean, you don't
have
to have watched it inside and out, but...
Your biggest event that you ever do, having... It's okay, I'm going to give a weird comparison here. See this? Kendrick Lamar's halftime show was the barrier to entry. Like, for people who are upset about it, he wasn't playing songs aside from one, right? That were really even that popular on the national scale. And so I was thinking, like, there was the era where they had, like, classic rock artists or whatever. They had the medley era in, like, the early 2000s. And then they had, like, Bruce Springsteen and Prince and people like that. Those songs, the amount of people in the United States of America and the world who know Prince songs, it's just had, you've had 20 fucking years to hear the song over and over and over and over again. But like Kendrick Lamar playing a song from an album that came out in November, like they're just not, people aren't going to know those songs that well. You know what I mean? It's not in your soul in the same way that like Bruce Springsteen is, because it's generations that have happened. So it's almost like there's like a higher barrier to entry. And so for SNL to have the biggest moment, this is like probably, it will probably be the highest viewed SNL event of the last 10 years or something, right?
Yeah,
I would assume.
Of course.
It's in primetime stuff. But to have that be referential or like have a higher barrier to entry, the sketches is kind of strange because most people watching are not going to have seen a bunch of the sketches, but they are familiar with the famous people. You know, and I think that's right. Kind of what it's about.
Yeah, that's what your children didn't have. It's like, but for mom, even though she is a fairly devoted SNL viewer, just like seeing a bunch of famous people is enough for her. I like that. Do you know who the first act was after the Janet Jackson, Justin Timberlake halftime show?
The next year?
Yeah. In the classic rock era, as you put it.
Oh, God. Was it the Rolling Stones?
They were the second. You were missing where I was going with this.
Was it Paul McCartney?
Sir Paul McCartney.
So yeah. Oh, I mean,
he's the overlay. But
so they know what they're doing also as far as like finding somebody who's going to show up, play the hits, not be too controversial, you know?
But Paul McCartney's performance is, I think, the interesting example here, because obviously you could enjoy it just because of the fact that it's Paul McCartney.
Yes.
And he's one of our greatest living musicians. But there was kind of an inside joke to the fact that he ended with the love you take is equal to the love you make, which was a callback to his Chris Farley show appearance.
Do you think that was intentional that it was?
I don't know if it was intentional or not.
Did he do a medley? I haven't gotten to that part yet. Did he do a medley of the second half of Abbey Road, right?
I mean, I think the song itself is a medley.
He did the whole thing. I haven't seen what songs he did. But that's really funny. If that was intentional, then fair.
But it's Band on the Run is what he did.
He played Band on the Run?
Yeah.
Okay. And then he did the like Golden Slumbers medley.
Yeah. Yeah. So
he was playing at Bowery Ballroom all last week, like three shows, and people were showing. Are you aware of this?
No.
And I was thinking about like, I mean, Bowery Ballroom's like 575 tickets. It's smaller than Numo's. And it was Paul fucking McCartney playing like hits. That's the crazy thing about it is I feel like I had a friend text me about Paul Simon playing at Benaroya Hall, and I was like, I'm good. But Paul McCartney with a band playing Paul McCartney hits at Bowery Ballroom is like, that is a thing that I feel like is going to be pretty hard to see. And then I saw that he did SNL, and I was like, oh, that's why he's doing this. It was three warm-up shows for doing SNL, doing the small things.
I thought the sketches that haven't aged well was a really hilarious highlight reel to run during this. I thought they handled that quite well.
Yeah, it's better than just being ashamed or whatever.
Or ignoring it.
Yeah. No, I have to go back and watch that. I saw people talking about that. Have you seen the Saturday Night Movie?
No, I haven't seen that yet.
So that was on Netflix. I mean, they timed everything quite well, I felt like, with it. And that was on Netflix. I think it debuted on Netflix on Friday. And Netflix is just always going to be like the biggest app. So the most amount of people, again.
Whatever like Netflix puts center stage is always just going to be prominent.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was, I thought it was a good decision timing for it. I'm sure a lot of people saw it this weekend right before that and helped the hype for everything. So I consumed SNL content of, there's a Peacock docuseries. Did you watch any of this?
Still haven't seen that, no.
So the first one was about auditions, which I thought was awesome because it's just fun seeing famous people's auditions.
Yes.
And seeing the crazy thing to me was how many of the characters from the auditions ended up being characters that they played.
Because I was listening to something where we talked about this and you said this exact same thing 10 years ago.
Really? There we go. 10 years, time's passed.
But your take is still the same. All takes Tristan has not changed on this one.
What was my take?
That it's the same thing, how fully formed they were.
The children didn't even know A Night at the Roxbury, and I was like, ah. Did I say that having Mr. Peepers fully formed at your audition for Chris Kattan is like...
But a lot of these things have been developed over like, you know, years and years at the Groundlings, yes, or UCB or Second City or wherever people were. So it's not surprising from that standpoint.
The second was about, it was just about the More Cowbell sketch, which I thought was terrible. It was just like...
A full hour on the More Cowbell sketch?
It was not good. It was a shocking miss. Because again, like the sketch is fine, but I don't feel like I don't know if any sketch ages well. But like if they would have done it about digital shorts, because I feel like digital shorts have aged very well. And you like watch the More Cowbell thing and it's funny, but it's kind of like digital shorts is how we view things now. You know?
Right.
That was almost like predicting the future.
But also like there's been a lot of digital shorts. And, you know, we often joke about like the rewatchables where the podcast is longer than the movie. But this was an hour long documentary about a 5-minute sketch is stretching that probably to its logical extremes.
It was like they were trying to make a documentary about it specifically. It was not good. And then the third one was like a week in the writer's room, basically, and just how intense it was. And it's like, you know, all the people, it's fun seeing the PDD dudes just like in their office.
Right.
You know, like the sketches happen in their office, but they're actually just working their job in there. So that's pretty fun.
They're not constantly doing heightened things with celebrities.
Yes. Yeah.
That makes host.
But so I thought that was awesome. And then you think about like what it would be like working there. And it is like obviously a very intense environment. And so I thought both of those. And then I watched the Saturday Night Movie. And I thought it was pretty bad. Overall.
Okay.
It's literally just about the first episode. It's so like aware of itself, if that makes sense. And it's giving so much importance. And then you see the sketches and you're like, these aren't actually very funny overall. Like some of the bit, like the actors are all pretty good.
You also said that 10 years ago.
Right? About the early sketches.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm not. I've had the same opinion for 10 years. My perspective about
probably longer than that.
Early SNL is probably not going to change. Like, I get it. I understand it. But yeah, the movie was just, it's so like self-important about this era. And ultimately, like, none of these people are that famous anymore. Lorne Michaels is by far, and he's the centerpiece of the movie, but he's maybe the most famous of them. But like, and the dude who played Dan Aykroyd is awesome, by the way. The person who played Gilda Radner and the person who played Dan Aykroyd were really good, but the rest of it, like the doing sort of impressions of people but sort of trying to capture their energy, didn't work very well. The Chevy Chase was really bad, and I was reading the Wikipedia and it was like Dan Aykroyd was like, it's a masterpiece top to bottom, and then Chevy Chase was like, you should be ashamed of yourself for this. And I was like, Dan Aykroyd seemed really cool after seeing it, and Chevy Chase seemed like an asshole after seeing it. So,
well,
it
I was surprised Chevy
true.
Was there. Where do I know Dylan O'Brien from? The other two? Was he in that?
Was Dylan O'Brien in the other two? I thought he was really good.
I know him from something, but I'm not. yeah, he was in the other two. Yeah.
Wait, who is he in? Is he the?
He plays himself. He also was notably in the short film of the extended version of Taylor Swift's All Too Well.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one. He plays himself?
Yeah.
In the other two? Wait, what is he doing in it, though?
I can't remember exactly.
Carrie becomes somewhat of a name. They date each other or something?
I don't think they dated each other, but it was just like he was a famous person that was around.
It also felt like they were really intentionally trying to have one of those casts that you look back on and you're like, whoa, those people were in it.
Right.
And sometimes those miss, you know, like I feel like it almost works better when you're unintentionally doing that. Than
wait, Cousin Greg played both Andy Kaufman and Jim Henson.
Yes.
Did that work?
It honestly was one of the better parts of the movie.
Okay. Well, I mean, look, the more Cousin Greg, the better. It goes without saying.
I don't feel like Andy Kaufman is funny to a modern audience. Like, it requires so much backstory to understand him, but almost nobody has, like, their moment. And it's kind of just about Lorne Michaels running around and, like, being stressed and figuring things out and how everybody cheered against them. It's almost feels like a sports movie where it's like, nobody believes in you, and then they triumphed, you know? And I was like, all right, like, the arc of this movie is not very interesting, and you know, like, the show's been on for 50 fucking years now. Like, the telling of the first episode is less compelling than you probably think it is, because to me the most exciting parts are like seeing like the 90s SNL, right? You know, like our era would be probably like Will Ferrell era, but like we all know that the best cast ever was like 92 or whatever.
But
you know,
people hated the 92 cast.
Or
that's
whatever
I find hilarious is, but like all of this stuff gets lost to history.
You know that when Phil Hartman was there, any time that Phil Hartman was there, the cast was phenomenal.
Of course.
But Phil Hartman and just all of those people just like being in a room hanging out, you're just like, yeah, that would probably be a fun thing to see. But I'm like, as a person who's not a boomer, these 70s people don't really matter that much to me.
Yeah, I guess it does suffer from a target demographic because it's about them as young people, but it's marketed exclusively to people who were the same age at that point.
Yeah.
So
it's also just not that entertaining of a movie overall. Like, but again, I watched the whole thing. By the end, like, you hear Lorne Michaels' speech and you're like, all right, yeah, pretty good. They pulled it off. But yeah, you're just like Billy Preston, and I'm like, Billy Preston's not a person who I don't have like a long history with Billy Preston in the same way. So I thought that was kind of it's not SNL's fault, but I just thought the movie itself was, you could feel the attempt.
Wait, you don't feel like you got to know Billy Preston in the Beatles documentary?
I mean, I watched like the first one.
Oh yeah. He livens things up when he shows up.
Yeah.
All right.
I heard it needed it. I don't know. I just don't ever care about anything though.
Great for podcasting.
You know what I mean? Like, we were going around at Mopop, and I'm just like, yeah, I don't care. I don't care about any of this stuff. Seeing Jimi Hendrix's cardigan or Kurt Cobain's cardigan, it's like, I could care less. It's a cardigan. I don't give a shit who wore it. You know what I mean? Like, none of that stuff matters to me. The seeing things where you're like, oh yeah, cool, Kim Kardashian wore that.
So you're basically great. Chad, is what you're telling me.
Chad? Who's Chad? Chad?
Oh, you didn't see that part of the SNL 50?
Oh, is it the Pete Davidson character? He's like,
yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
Cool. I mean, right? Like, who's that moved by these things?
Paul Allen, I guess.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, it's the Death Star. Cool. Great.
Okay.
No emotional response to an item. The Keith Haring exhibit was the only thing where I was like, this actually rules. But you feel the time period when you go look at Keith Haring paintings, right? They're mostly screen prints, and you see it and you're like, yeah, like I can feel New York in like 1988. So you're saying
you couldn't feel New York 1975 in Saturday Night?
They tried to capture it, but I just don't feel like that was... It's all in the room. It's not right. Like outside of it. And so Lorne Michaels' speech is like, this is what the show is. It's like this moment where you like walk in, you see Paul Simon in the back of a small venue or whatever, like these magical moments. That's what SNL is. And I'm like, I kind of get that. Like, I do feel like it's a little bit of a glimpse in New York, but the fact now, not really that much anymore, but the fact that it's so contained inside of the studio and it's just about the iconography. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the Keith Haring thing wasn't about the iconography. It's about the art overall. And it's about feeling like you're in this moment. So that was the only thing where I was like, this actually rules. Otherwise, I did see a dress that Lizzo wore.